Live from New York, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. How does oxygen help to heal foot wounds in diabetics? We'll explore it. From headaches to jaundice, cures for liver ailments, the rise and the rise again of vegetarianism, sausage, bacon, and roast dinners. Yeah, those used to be the staple of many people, especially Great Britain residents. Well, now they're calling it flexitarians. They're foregoing meat. And plus, we're going to explore today, a former science chief says the MMR vaccines fears are coming true. I'll quote from Sue Corrigan from the Daily Mail, how a former government medical officer responsible for deciding whether medicines are safe or not has accused the government of, quote, utterly inexplicably complacency over the MMR triple vaccine for children. Well, hold on. Wasn't it Andrew Wakefield? No, this was the top government official. Why aren't the media paying attention to that? We'll deal with that. Stupidity of belief. The inner politics and nature of mankind have not changed. Then depressing survey shows how extremely stupid Americans have become. You think? And research shows TV is intellectually and socially dumbing down young children. Just young children? Wow. I thought everyone gets dumbed down by television. Also today, I'm sure many of you have heard the idea, live each day like it's your last. Good. And I'm sure you're also aware that there are more than 3,000 death cafes around the United States where people meet. And it's not just here, it's also in 30 countries. And they talk about death. Who knew? I got a problem with it. And Roman Kersnerik of Yeth Magazine has a problem also. I'll share my problems, and I'll give you his five reasons that live each day like it's your last. It's really stupid. Not just stupid. It's dumb, dumb, and dumbest. Dumber than dumb. But we're going to share that with you. I have some very important insights on that. And then I want you to hear the exact words from one of the most, if the most decorated general in American history. Smedley Butler. Smedley Butler is the recipient of two of the highest awards, the highest awards in all of military activity. He also ran a lot of the campaigns for the United States government in Cuba, in South America, in the Philippines. And then one day, a group of people wanted to have a coup, and they had the opportunity, the money, the bankers, and they wanted him to head it. And he said no. And then he came out with something rather profound. He came out with what you're going to hear today. War is a racket. Now, I want you to listen carefully to what he says, word for word. And then I want you to look at that as a template and how perfectly it fits everyone in the media who is Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama and the Clintons. Everyone who is out there beating the drums, they're part of that racket. They're profiting from it. Right now, as I'm speaking, there's at least 300,000 plus people in just Washington, D.C. area whose work is involved in making sure that you're afraid that sometime during the night, a terrorist is going to do something in your community. And so that you will not question the money that they're spending on themselves, all self-interested, and when it would only take about $100 billion a year versus the $1.5 billion. So wouldn't it be better to save $1.4 trillion and use it on reconstruction projects and helping re-industrialize America with living wages? They keep you scared, so we have that. There's a very important statement by Dr. Suzanne Humphreys, who has spent, as I mentioned yesterday, 15,000 plus hours, more or less, studying the actual science of vaccines on safety and efficacy, going clear back to the beginning. I will put her against any person on the planet when it comes to her knowledge of the safety and efficacy of vaccines. Not the politics, just the safety and efficacy. And I want you to hear what she has to say. Now, this message is not for this audience because most of the people in this audience already are educated after almost 40 articles written, fully referenced on the dangers and lack of efficacy and safety in vaccines, on all the different documentaries, my own and others, that we have provided to the public. You're up to date. But what about all the people who are running vaccine damage foundations, bringing in millions of dollars, frequently through the pharmaceutical companies, saying, well, we're pro-vaccine, but we're just against bad vaccines? We're going to talk about that lack of reason and then hear what she has to say. I did an original in-depth investigative report on what's behind the autism vaccine link with the MMR vaccine. I provided information that's never been heard, that no one has published, that no one knows about. You really need to hear this, especially those who are uncertain. First up, we all know we should be having more fruits and vegetables, ideally locally grown, organic, wherever possible. But if it meant that you don't have vegetables or fruits because they've been sprayed, I'd rather you buy them and clean them, and you can get most of the residual material off. Otherwise, you're depriving your body and your cells of some very important nutrients. This is the latest in public health nutrition as presented in Science Daily. Boston University School of Medicine found that pregnant women that consumed at least 7 servings a day of fruits and vegetables reduced the risk of developing upper respiratory tract infections. That's important because upper respiratory tract infections, including the common cold and sinus infections, which can lead to lower respiratory problems, such as asthma and pneumonia, and all these complications from colds, why have it if you could just increase your fruits and vegetables? They studied 1,000 pregnant women to do this. So the takeaway message is, if you are pregnant, you should be flooding the body with fruits and vegetables. 6.7 servings a day? No. Way too little. Let's try 12 to 13 servings a day. Then you're getting yourself really the benefit of that. I lecture a lot about vegetarianism around the world, and I have a new film that I haven't shown yet. It'll be premiered this June, hopefully, if I'm doing the historical narrative right now, and all the principal photography over the last 12 months is done, filmed all over the world. It'll be the most definitive film ever done on vegetarianism. And it's not Saving the Planet One Bite at a Time. That's a separate film. And what I'm finding is more and more people are coming forward saying, yeah, let's try. But not everyone can do it all at once. And in some circles within the vegan community, they're extremely radicalized and very self-righteous, and I believe close the door on a lot of people. We have to be extremely empathetic with people who've lived a life eating one way, and now we're asking them to make changes. And I think if someone's able to go cold turkey and go off all the junk food and give up the caffeine and everything and go all natural, organic, and healthy, good. But most people, the answer, 95% of the people in my experience, which is formidable, is no. So one thing at a time. If they just took one day a week and made it meatless, then after a month, 2 days a week. After another month, 3 days a week. It might take a year before they finally get off all the animal products, but then they're really benefiting. This is from the Independent, United Kingdom. Quote, forget lentils and tofu. Vegetarian cooking is enjoying a makeover, prompting meat eaters to put down their steak knives. New green cuisine is tapping into the rise of flexitarian, the occasional vegetarian who is helping their waistline and the planet by eating less meat. A new crop of vegetarian restaurants is springing up, catering to rising demand of meat-free dining options. Even established restaurants, such as Aldo Zilli, are jumping on the bandwagon. Zilli is considered axing meat from one of his London eateries completely to cash in on the new trend. He's even mulling rechristening one of them Zilli Green. And other chefs, including Oliver Payton, are increasing the number of meat-free choices on their existing menus. From Sir Paul McCartney, who wants us all to eschew meat on Mondays, to Che Chavero's granddaughter, who is starring in a new all-meat, anti-meat campaign for a group of people, there is no shortage of high-profile figures. Vegetarian food is no longer the crunchy preserve of a small minority, but is hitting the mainstream. A recent poll from the Food Development Association showed 86% of Britons eat non-meat meals once or twice a week, forcing restaurants to follow suit. Quote, historically, chefs haven't liked vegetarians, but that is changing. Younger chefs particularly understand the need for vegetarian food. So many more people want vegetarian food these days, and it's my job to cater to them, said one of the major restaurants in England. He's offering up to 3 meat-free alternatives per course. That's substantial. He's one of a band of chefs, including one of the most famous, who created the Meat-Free Monday drive, which wants people to cut out meat to help slow climate change, since livestock production pumps more greenhouse gas emissions in the atmosphere than transportation. So it's happening all over London. I remember last time I was in London, I went to Crank's, and they have some tasty food. And Neil's Yard, which is just so beautiful if you've never been there. It's a small little space, and it's near Piccadilly. It's exactly the way it was hundreds of years ago. You walk down this little alley and cobblestone, and then you're in, you look to your left and here are all these little storefronts, that health food store and a green market of fresh produce, and all serving natural green products. So the English have been, at least those who are aware of it, have been into vegetarianism for a long time. So I'm just glad to see that so many people are now making that move. And I believe that if we get the youth behind this in a big way in the United States, it'll make a difference. So we're going to do all we can to make that happen starting this summer. From headache to jaundice. This is a study about a particular simple flower. That flower is called chicory. I'm sure people in this audience have tried chicory. It's one of what is known as the sky blue flowers. And they're blooming all along city roadways and fields. And chances are most people have seen it. They just didn't know that it was edible. But it has a long tradition of medicinal use. Why? Chicory is one of your best detoxifications for your liver. And it's known for the fact that its blue flowers open and close precisely the same time every day. It was back in Roman times that chicory was used to treat liver ailments. Even in the land of Persia and Arabia and India, physicians used it widely to what was called creating heat in the body. It worked as a laxative also. It's similar to dandelion. The leaves can be eaten in early spring, and they get bitter once the plant flowers. And the long taproots can be dug, dried, and roasted. And that's chicory as a coffee substitute. And it's used in commercial teas. And so it's just good. It's just rarely used. So let's suggest that if you want to cleanse the liver, help the liver, detoxify toxins out of the liver, that you use chicory to do it. Also, oxygen can heal. Hyperbaric oxygen is one of the best things in the world to heal, from burns to the bends. And this is from the latest study from Queensland University of Technology. They're finding that oxygen treatment can help diabetics heal foot wounds and avoid lower limb amputation. How bad is it? Every 30 seconds, a person somewhere in the world loses a lower limb to amputation due to diabetic foot disease. But now this study, and an international team, found that oxygen can heal the debilitating wounds that plague people with diabetes. In this study, scientists modeled the use of hyperbaric oxygen therapy, what is called HBOT, which is the intermittent exposure of the body to pure oxygen under pressure, and that's what caused it to heal. So it would also be terrific if you ever had a stroke. In fact, it's never used for this, but let me just tell you, it saved lives. If you ever have a stroke, have a card on you that says, "I demand to receive hyperbaric oxygen therapy." That could save your life, because the hyperbaric oxygen therapy can also stop the massive destruction of the tissue around where the stroke or the embolism is. And even if you've had a stroke up to 6 years ago, it can still help. So that's the latest on health and healing. We'll be back in a moment. Please stay with us. A special shout out to all of you all over the world. We're heard all over the world and all throughout different syndicated stations in the United States. And also, we're the number one radio station in all of North or South America where people listen over the telephone. In fact, I was told, I'm on the road, that the company that provides us called on Friday last week and said, broke all records in the history of the service, 66,000. Whoa! So we got a lot of people listening daily, and especially on Friday. Here's the number. Anytime that you're out and about and you're not near your internet or not near a land base station on the radio, you got listening devices, call this number at noon, 712-775-6850. 712-775-6850. Let's think about how stupid our beliefs are for a moment, or how primitive we can be. Not everyone, of course. Around 1600, when Europeans began to use the methods of learning that are now called scientific, Galileo peered at the moon. In 1969, a man walked on the moon. That means in less than 400 years, people went from peering at the moon to walking on it. Now, I've spoken many times on this program that mankind is creedal rather than rational. That an ideology, a creed, a dogma, a belief, is a lie that will never die. Religions and religious beliefs certainly exhibit those characteristics. The primitive nature of religion is also evident. In the ancient world, religious rites were practices to honor gods. Today, they are used to dispatch dead souls to their rightful places in eternity. The funerals of Nancy Reagan, for example, and the Supreme Court Justice are examples of rites that date at least as far back as the Roman Empire. It's clear that the conventional notion is that religious belief is a higher virtue. Those with it are considered to be better than those without it. This notion persists despite the large number of logical absurdities that have been identified in religious doctrines and other creeds. And despite this history, people seem to be addicted to creeds. In the United States of America, whose Constitution prohibits the Congress from adopting a state religion, officials still commonly speak in the language of belief. Yet religious Americans worship multiple gods. Freedom of religion is a constitutional right, so the word God in these expressions has no definitive denotation. The God of the New Testament is incompatible with the God of the Torah. Americans seem oblivious to the fact that a sentence containing a substantive with no truth is utterly meaningless, and any connotation it possesses is entirely subjective. The French during the Revolution in 1789 sought to destroy the Catholic religion, specifically and religion in general, but in 1801 Napoleon signed an agreement with Pope Pius VII, marking an end to the attempt. Similarly, during the First World War, Orthodox Russian prelates carried holy icons through the trenches before battles, begging God to bring victory in coming battles, only to see the Russian army annihilated instead. So when the Russian Revolution occurred in 1917, the newly created Union of Soviet Socialist Republics banned religion and locked the doors to all churches. Yet in 1991, then, when the USSR was transformed into the Russian Federation, the church doors were unlocked and the Russian people flocked to the churches to resume their faith in the Orthodox Church. Similar attempts to promote the eradication of religious beliefs are going on in China with no success. What accounts for this persistence of creedology? In fact, this persistence is so strong that it is commonly considered to be virtuous. The admonition, stand up for your knowledge, is never heard, but stand up for your belief is common. Yet if beliefs are claims that are not known to be true or cannot ever be known to be true, the admonition advises people to maintain and flaunt their ignorance. Creedology is an attribute that we should ponder. Still, creeds seem to be what human beings live by. Just take a look at the medical profession. It was found that doctors were not giving chemotherapy because they knew or had scientific evidence that they had a high level of statistical improvement in the lifespan and quality of life of a person receiving their chemotherapy and radiation. It was their belief. So they could have a belief and then use misguided science and end up with a 530,000 to 50,000 dead people each year who believed in them, as if these were the priests of a religion, the religion of medicine. And think of all the parents who believe in the religion of vaccines, because the doctor believes in it. Can they show you the science? No, they cannot. It does not exist at all. When a psychiatrist says you have bipolar, can he show you? Is there any proof whatsoever? Is there an MRI? Is there blood chemistry? Is there anything to prove that you have schizophrenia, bipolar, any of their multiple definitions of mental illness? No, there's not. Not a single scientific paper in the world proves a biochemical imbalance causing any of these, but it's their belief, and therefore they have made their therapy into a religion, and you cannot challenge it, you cannot change it, you cannot alter it, you merely have to obey it, and if not, then you're punished. A doctor that wants to use a more humanistic or holistic approach in the treatment of a patient is shunned, feared by the true believers. So just understand, in creedology, if it's a banker who believes that it's better to have a world with $600 trillion in derivative positions, but won't give a nickel to open up a new factory producing green products in a destitute area of America that would help the local community, help the environment, help the world, which is scientifically proven to benefit people. They would rather go with the belief that it's better just to make money off money and forget the consequences to people. Everywhere you look, in every institution, creedology dominates. Rational thought is either an afterthought or is disdained. This is the results of a study. Michael Snyder shares this with us. Quote, I truly believe that if people of average intellect from the 1950s and 60s were transported to 2016, they would likely be considered a lot smarter than others today. Hardly anyone takes time to read a book anymore, and yet the average American spends 301 minutes a day watching television. 75% of our younger adults cannot find Israel on a map of the Middle East, but they sure know how to find smut on the internet. It may be hard to believe, but there are more than 4 million porno websites on the internet today, and they get more traffic than Netflix, Amazon, and Twitter combined. What in the world has happened to us? How is it possible that we have become so stupid? According to a brand new report that was recently released, almost 10% of our college graduates believe that Judge Judy is on the Supreme Court. What, she's not? The American Council of Trustees and Alumni publishes occasional reports on what college students know. Nearly 10% of the college graduates surveyed thought Judith Sheindlin, TV's Judge Judy, is a member of the U.S. Supreme Court. Less than 20% of college graduates knew the effect of the Emancipation Proclamation. More than a quarter of college graduates did not know Franklin D. Roosevelt was president during World War II. He was a president? One-third did not know he was the president who spearheaded the New Deal. What New Deal? On a cell phone? Yep. It can be tempting to look at these numbers and say, well, it doesn't matter. Yeah, it does. Just consider what Newsweek found out. When Newsweek recently asked 1,000 U.S. citizens to take America's official citizenship test, 29% couldn't name the vice president. No. We have a vice president? When did that happen? 73% couldn't correctly say why we fought in the Cold War. 44% were unable to define the Bill of Rights. And 6% couldn't even circle Independence Day on a calendar. Even worse, there were extremely depressing results of a study conducted a few years ago by Common Core. Only 43% of all high school students knew that the Civil War was fought between 1850, and they thought it was fought between 1850 and 1900. More than a quarter of all U.S. high school students thought Christopher Columbus made his famous voyage across the Atlantic around 1750. It's only off a couple of years. Approximately a third of all U.S. high school students did not know the Bill of Rights guaranteed freedom of speech and freedom of religion. Only 60% of all U.S. students knew the World War I was fought sometime between 1900 and 1950. And, of course, survey results can be skewed. But, man, Americans born after 1980 are lagging their peers in countries ranging from Australia to Estonia. So, and half of all American millennials score below the minimum standards of literacy proficiency. Over half. Wow. So how did we become such a stupid nation? Oh, a whole lot of reasons. I'm sure that I'm not alone in realizing that there's a lot of a vapid thought out there. And if you don't have an understanding of history, if you don't understand cultures, if you don't understand races, if you don't understand our economic system, our political system, our health system, then how are you supposed to function? And by the way, it didn't get any better when it came to college students. After 2 years in college, 45% of students showed no significant gains in learning. After 4 years of college, 36% showed no change. Students also spend 50% less time studying compared with students a few decades ago. Yeah, but for all the cupcakes, and we have a lot of them, asking a kid to do homework today, that's punishment. That's a child abuse, isn't it? Can't you, as a kid, say to the teacher, I don't want it. You're making me feel very bad today. I'm going to have some counseling. You're asking me to do homework? Whoa. No, dude. Yeah. 35% of college students today spend 5 hours or less per week studying. 50% said they never took a class in a typical semester where they wrote more than 20 pages. 32% never took a course in a typical semester where they read more than 40 pages per week. Wow. And it gets worse than there. They're watching television 4 hours, 32 minutes a day. They're on time-shifting television 30 minutes a day. Listening to the radio 2 hours and 44 minutes a day. Using a smartphone 1 hour and 33 minutes a day. Using the internet 1 hour and 6 minutes a day. And so it goes. Those are some of the reasons that we are dumbing down. And finally on that subject, quote from the Natural Blaze, it is common for parents to feel that their children are spending too much time in front of the television set. According to a study, children who watch an excessive amount of television exhibit a multitude of negative side effects, including poor language and social skills, including bullying. The survey was to determine what would happen at about 2.5 years, and then compare that to school performance at 5.5 years. And the study was conducted, and, quote, increases in total time watching television at 29 months was associated with substantial subsequent decreases in vocabulary, math skills, classroom engagement, victimization by classmates, and physical prowess at kindergarten. So that's that. And finally, from Sue Corrigan, a former government medical, this is the top medical official, the number one in the whole country, Dr. Peter Fletcher, who was chief scientific officer at the Department of Health, said if it is proven that the vaccine causes autism, quote, the refusal by governments to evaluate the risks properly will make this one of the greatest scandals in medical history. Why didn't we know this? Why didn't anyone hear this? So this wasn't a rogue person. This wasn't an investigative journalist. This was the top person in the entire country saying this. He added that after agreeing to be an expert witness on drug safety trials for these, he had received and studied thousands of documents relating to the case, which he believed the public had a right to see. He said he had seen, quote, a steady accumulation of evidence from scientists worldwide that the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine is causing brain damage in certain children. For the journalists who think, oh, there's no truth to any of that, yeah, there is. Let's now hear from Dr. Suzanne Humphreys on what she has to say. We'll play only about 5 minutes of this on vaccines. And there's no one smarter in the world on vaccines that I know of than Suzanne Humphreys, because she's done what none of the others have done. She's actually done her homework.
When it came up in my professional life, and my current opinion about vaccinations is that they have never been safe. Never has there been a safe vaccine. Never will there be a safe vaccine. And it is not possible to have a safe vaccine. The reasoning for that is that the actual process of vaccination defies the natural function of the immune system of living beings. It thwarts the immune system into a balance that's very unnatural and that leaves it susceptible to more things than just what you've maybe vaccinated supposedly for. Putting a disease matter into a body and thinking that the manner of which it's going in, i.e. usually through a muscle, through the skin, using a very unnatural thing, a needle, combined with all the chemicals and antibiotics and things that the manufacturing companies may not even know about at the time that they're being injected into a muscle, there's no possible way that that can be safe. Now, when you're bypassing the normal immune system by putting this disease matter into a muscle, you are stimulating yet another abnormal response at the site of the injection, pooling of all sorts of metals and things that call in the immune cells in this very unnatural way. And the result that these manufacturers or designers of vaccines often look for is simply an antibody, which is one small thing in the cascade of immunity that is so incredibly elegant they probably cannot appreciate, obviously don't appreciate, if calling a simple antibody, which is highly unpredictable, immunity, is insanity. If indeed it is such a miraculous product, wouldn't we be noticing how miraculous it is? Are they saying that we are just too stupid to notice that this is killing people and maiming people, that we're too stupid to notice that it's miraculous? You know, I think that is a lot of the argument. We're just too stupid to notice how miraculous this is. So to protect everybody, they're going to give it to us anyway. Why must such a wonderful product be forced upon people since the beginning of vaccination? If people were really seeing each other dropping dead of smallpox and they were really seeing each other being saved by a smallpox vaccine, the line would be out of town, you know, to get it. That's never been the case. The history books really show that the people that were vaccinated were among the sickest, that many children were dying after smallpox vaccinations, that they were developing terrible ulcerations, beautiful, perfect babies, you know, forced into smallpox vaccines, either dying or developing terrible, terrible diseases. And the diseases are often said, oh, that would have happened anyway. But Parents who watch this happen time and again know otherwise. So those of us who actually notice the science is not backing up vaccination, those of us who notice that people are being maimed and killed by vaccinations, those of us who have experienced our own vaccine reactions are categorically thought to be mad, despite the fact that we've actually studied it. You know, none of my colleagues in the past studied vaccines, yet they still would think that the sound bites that they heard over and over and over the years about vaccines being safe and effective trumped any book knowledge that I may have attained and tried to discuss with them. It's baffling. It's like the minds have been sucked into this paradigm so deeply, and it's not just the minds of these doctors, but it's the safety net, and it's the comfort zone, and it's the rewards that they're getting as a result of all they're doing. And the rewards are not watching people get healthy. The rewards are monetary and the rewards are power. That's it. It's money and it's power. Many of the vaccine enthusiast doctors will parrot the phrase that babies need to be vaccinated when they're young because the take rate is better for the vaccine. Parents are being told to bring their 2-month, 4-month, 6-month-old infants in to have them injected with some 24 different disease matter injections, complete with the polysorbate 80, amounts of aluminum that are absolutely unsafe with the amount of body weight they're being injected into, which, by the way, is to generate the immune response that's desired. That's what the aluminum is there for. They're being told to bring these children in, and the real reason is because they need to get them there at 1 year. They need to train the parents. So to train the parents, they're injecting these children. I mean, how sick is this? If it's only to train the parents, then why not just give them a saline injection at 2, 4, and 6 months, and let's just keep it to ourselves? Why do we have to inject disease matter that won't be effective and that will be problematic?
That is one part. That's 5 minutes of a 15-minute segment. The rest of it is posted on our website, progressiveradionetwork.com, or my Facebook. It's worth listening to. Mind you, she is up for debating any pro-vaccine advocate or physician or scientist. They won't debate her because she just makes mincemeat out of them. She has facts. They have opinions. They have belief. And you could imagine how she is thought of. She's feared and she's hated, not because she's wrong, but because she's right. I'm going to take your calls in just a moment, and then we're going to hear from Smedley Butler about war. But I promised you I'd give some insights on why we should not live each day. And part of this came from a very famous talk by Steve Jobs back in 2005. He was the Apple co-founder, in a comment speech at Stanford University, and it went viral, and it was on YouTube. About 30 million people downloaded it. He was about 50 years at the time, and he described his previous 33 years, he started every morning by looking in the mirror and asking himself, if today were the last day of my life, what I want to do, what I'm doing, and will do today. And if the answer was no on too many days in a row, he claimed he knew he needed to make a change, remembering, I'll be dead soon. And that was the moment he realized that he should change his life. So that was something that was important. Also, he also had pancreatic cancer. And a lot of people took that literally. We've always had people who've pondered life. Remember the great Stoic thinker, philosopher Seneca, who wrote the book on the shortness of life, and that so many people squander their lives on, he said, wine, lust, greed, and ambition. The problem, remember, is not that we have a short time to live, but that we waste so much of it. There's nothing the busy man is less busy with than living. He said, plans out our day is the last thing. So the idea is living each day as if it were your last sounds great. Those new age, touchy-feely, let's all kind of wave together. But it's nonsense. Why? You then live purely through immediate gratification. That means that you wouldn't have children because that takes time. And as a parent that woke up and would change my little baby Shelley's diaper and make sure that she was fed and all the other things, that's not always joyful. It's joyful having a child, but you see the rewards as his child evolves and goes through the transitions, and you're part of it, and you're there every day. But you have to be patient for that. Ask any parent. There are times when you're a parent where it's frustrating, yeah, where it's very humbling, yes. Not that that's a bad thing. That's a good thing. But you might not see the, you're not going to see instant gratification. And then what about the idea if you didn't reverse? What if you woke up each day and say, this is not the last day of my life. This is the first day. What would you do different? Think of how many new ideas would fill your mind. You would be in awe and wonder at the world and think of all the ways that you would look at nature. You would take your time. You would see things new. You would try new foods and experience new tastes. You would use more emotions in speaking with people. You would look for different people because everything would be as innocent and new as a child revealing that day. I think that's far more positive way of looking at life than, oh, this is my last day, so what can I pack into this last day? Because if it's your last day, you're going to be living with fear, remorse, guilt, anger that it's your last day, and regrets of what you didn't do. But if it's your first day, you have none of that. You just say, let me see what I can do with this day to make it special. Think of the ideas you would not otherwise venture that you will have. Also, I believe when we live as if it's our last day, we're going to live recklessly. I've counseled tens of thousands of people, and so many of them resent the fact they didn't live their own authentic life. So I said, now's the time to do it. What do you mean now? I'm dying. Who says you're dying? Well, I've got terminal disease. Well, that's their opinion. Is your mind dying? Is your spirit dying? Is your imagination dying? Is that terminal? Well, I never thought of that. Well, I'm able to help people because I don't think the way other people think. They only know what they know, and they're afraid to know anything else because it would compete with their own ego and achievements and self-worth and their hierarchical position. Why don't you just realize that life is a wonderful place as long as you can let your mind free? And also there's something that the great Indian sages taught us. Always do everything as if there were seven generations to follow that would be responsible or affected. I believe that's Steve Jobs' greatest blind sight, is to speak as if there is no such thing as society, just a world of individuals whose actions have no apparent impact on one another. Those are my thoughts. Now, let's hear a few words from Smedley Butler. Actual words.
War is a racket. It always has been. It is possibly the oldest, easily the most profitable, surely the most vicious. It is international in scope. It is the only one in which the profits are reckoned in dollars and the losses in lives. There are only two things we should fight for. One is the defense of our homes, and the other is the Bill of Rights. War for any other reason is simply a racket. It may seem odd for me, a military man, to adopt such a comparison. Truthfulness compels me to. I spent 33 years and 4 months in active military service as a member of this country's most agile military force, the Marine Corps. I served in all commissioned ranks from second lieutenant to major general. And during that period, I spent most of my time being a high-class muscle man for big business, for Wall Street, and for the bankers. I suspected I was just part of a racket at the time. Now I am sure of it. I helped make Mexico safe for American oil interests in 1914. I helped make Haiti and Cuba a decent place for the National Citibank boys. I helped in the raping of half a dozen Central American republics for the benefits of Wall Street. I helped purify Nicaragua for the international banking house of Brown Brothers in 1910. I brought light to the Dominican Republic for American sugar interests in 1916. In China, I helped to see to it that Standard Oil went its way unmolested. Looking back on it, I feel I could have given Al Capone a few tips. The best he could do was operate his racket in three districts. I operated on three continents. A racket is best described, I believe, as something that is not what it seems to the majority of the people. Only a small inside group knows what it is about. It is conducted for the benefit of the very few at the expense of the very many. In the World War, a mere handful garnered the profits of the conflict. At least 21,000 new millionaires and billionaires were made in the United States during the World War. How many of these war millionaires shouldered a rifle? How many of them dug a trench? How many of them knew what it meant to go hungry in a rat-infested dugout? How many of them spent sleepless, frightened nights ducking shells and shrapnel and machine gun bullets? Out of war, nations acquire additional territory if they are victorious. They just take it. This newly acquired territory promptly is exploited by the few, the selfsame few who wrung dollars out of blood in the war. The general public shoulders the bill. It would have been far cheaper and safer for the average American who pays the bills to stay out of foreign entanglements. For a very few, this racket, like bootlegging and other underworld rackets, brings fancy profits. But the cost of operations is always transferred to the people who do not profit. Take the World War. It cost the United States taxpayer some $52 billion, and we haven't paid that debt yet. But ultimately, it's the soldier who pays the biggest part of the bill. If you don't believe this, visit the American cemeteries on the battlefields abroad, or visit any of the veterans' hospitals in the United States. Napoleon once said, "All men are enamored of decorations. They positively hunger for them." So, by developing the Napoleonic system, the medal business, the government learned it could get soldiers for less money, because the boys liked to be decorated. Until the Civil War, there were no medals. Then the Congressional Medal of Honor was handed out. It made enlistments easier. In the World War, we used propaganda to make the boys accept conscription. They were made to feel ashamed if they didn't join the army. So vicious was this war propaganda that even God was brought into it. With few exceptions, our clergymen joined in the clamor to kill, kill, kill. To kill the Germans, God is on our side. It is His will that the Germans be killed. And in Germany, the good pastors called upon the Germans to kill the Allies, to please the same God. Beautiful ideals were painted for our boys who were sent out to die. This was the war to end all wars. This was the war to make the world safe for democracy. No one mentioned to them as they marched away that their going and their dying would mean huge war profits. Thus, having stuffed patriotism down their throats, it was decided to help make them pay for the war too. So we gave them the large salary of $30 a month. All they had to do for this munificent sum was to leave their dear ones behind, give up their jobs, lie in swampy trenches, and kill and kill and kill. And be killed. Well, war is a racket, all right. And the only way to smash this racket is to conscript capital, industry, and labor before the nation's manhood can be conscripted. Let all the officers, directors, high-powered executives, all the workers, managers, bankers, and yes, all the generals, admirals, officers, and all politicians, all government office holders, everyone in the nation, be restricted to a total monthly income not to exceed that paid to the soldier. Why shouldn't they? They aren't running any risk of being killed or having their bodies mangled or their minds shattered. The soldiers are. Give capital, industry, and labor 30 days to think it over, and I think you will find by that time there will be no war. Another step necessary in the fight to smash the war racket is the limited plebiscite to determine whether a war should be declared. A plebiscite not of all the voters, but merely of those who would be called upon to do the fighting and dying. There wouldn't be very much sense in having the president of a munitions factory, or the head of an international banking firm, or the manager of a uniform manufacturing plant, all of whom see visions of tremendous profits in the event of war, voting on whether the nation should go to war or not. They never would be called upon to shoulder arms. Only those who would be called upon to risk their lives for their country should have the privilege of voting to determine whether the nation should go to war. That would smash the war racket. That and nothing else.
And that's part of Smedley Butler, General Smedley Butler, the most decorated general in American history, who refused to be a part of a coup against Franklin Roosevelt by the bankers. Now, you show me anything he said that couldn't apply today just as realistically as during his long 30-plus year military career. And he was very honest. And then look at all the talking military heads on that are sent forth from think tanks today, and all connected with the munitions industry, the war armament or security industries. who never tell you anything except, yes, this is a threat and we need boots on the ground. We need more planes, more missiles, unlimited amounts of money spent. And all the presidential candidates say unlimited amounts of money, including Bernie Sanders. So this was one honest, uncompromised voice that I felt it was worth hearing. General Smedley Butler. I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you all for listening. Look forward to sharing more on our next program. Have a nice day.